briefly 40 years in practice, graduated from University of Illinois, and it has been a primarily ruminant practice, so cattle, sheep, and goats. Have been farming for 55 years. I'm on the home farm. We do have cattle, sheep, and goats, beef cattle, sheep, and goats ourselves. So I enjoy all those animals and know a fair bit about them in terms of the husbandry and the, of course, the medical part and the organic type treatments also. And I'm kind of branching off a little bit. I work with Dr. Paul's lab, so I'd get into some poultry and into some pigs, and the most recent foray has been into llamas. So that's a bit on my background.
So I'm Dr. Sarah Slaby. I also am the owner, besides a practicing veterinarian, predominantly large animal ruminants as well, specializing in dairy cattle. I've been a veterinarian for almost 20 years, graduated in 2003. I'm in the Arcadia area as well, 4 miles down the road from Dr. Tom and probably 7-10 miles from Dr. Detloff. So he was my vet, my family's vet when I was a little girl. So it's wonderful to be in an area with such smart, wonderful veterinarians. My husband, Noah, we have an organic farm. We sold milk to Organic Valley for 10 years. Right now we don't have the cows. 3 children, and my predominant business is Dr. Sarah's Essentials, which I started 16 years ago. Dr. Paul was my mentor at that time. He retired about the time I graduated. And there was a big need for farmers were looking for natural products and to treat their animals. And so Dr. Paul had the herbal tinctures and a lot of the herbal blends, and that's I branched kind of a little bit off to working with essential oils, and it complement each other very well. I started my research 17 years ago with essential oils on mastitis, and that is where my first product, the Savvy Udder, was developed, and has branched off to pet products and some human products. So that's my background. It's wonderful to be here.
So anyways, this is titled Ask the Vet, so you have our full attention here for an hour and beyond if you like. I hope everybody is comfortable being able to just ask questions. We do have paper and pens here if you feel more comfortable in writing questions, or if you think of questions later on that you would like us to get back to you on. Certainly are happy to be able to get in contact with you and answer specific questions. Yes.
So we did not get a spare mic. I will have to have you guys verbalize the questions before you answer.
Sure. Thank you. Sounds good. We can do that.
I'll just pass these around if anybody has a question. You can write them down.
Or is it easier for us to write them so it's easier for you to write them?
Not necessarily. No, no, whatever people are more comfortable with. So, first off, can I ask, how many of you folks have cattle? Okay.
Cattle.
Okay.
What do you mean by cattle?
Dairy or beef?
Somebody
dairy.
Told me that my goats were cattle.
Okay, that's the next part of the question. How many have goats? Okay, you have goats, okay. Anybody with sheep? All right. Anybody, pigs? Oh my, okay, great. And how about poultry? Yeah. It can be from, okay, one on up. And then how about llamas? That's good, because I'm still learning about llamas. I know a couple things. I could cover llamas really quickly. Anyways.
That's right.
All right, so who wants to start out? Who wants to ask first question? Yes.
I am farrowing pigs for my first time in a few months, and I would be curious, I'm very much a novice in this aspect, and looking for what are the best things to have on hand through a farrowing process, through piglets,
I don't like it. Birthing piglets.
Can I ask what breeding before you answer? Minor Berkshire gilts, which means they've never bred before. And there's a red wattle sperm donor.
The pork is pork.
Okay, so the question is, with coming into farrowing, which would be the pigs having their piglets, what would be the things to kind of watch for, as I understand?
And have
and
on hand.
And then the type of products to have on hand, what type of situations would you need to encounter and how would you handle them organically? Okay, so a gilt, first time that they're having babies, and because of that, things might take just a little bit longer than what it would in a sow, which would be an animal that has had multiple type of births. Typically, the things that we will see with farrowing with pigs, number one, it should be kind of a normal progression. You'd like to see the animals progressing, having the piglets on a 5-minute interval and coming out alive pigs, that type of thing. If there's an interruption with that, then you would want to possibly intercede. So the first thing you'd want to have on hand, I think, would be sleeves, some type of a protective covering, some type of a disinfectant for your water, and some type of a lubricant. They do make OB lubricants. You can do things like Dawn dish soap is real safe. It's real accessible in that. And don't be afraid to go in to check if you need to. The next thing, when the baby pigs come out, there isn't much that you would normally need to do with them other than make sure that they start breathing and that they're in a good position. They will normally try to find the udder. They'll do that on their own. In terms of then for the sow or for the gilt, at the time of farrowing, that is a time when you can have issues with either the udder or with the uterus. Uterus infections can be fairly common. From the organic standpoint, there are certain things, and this varies. You'll get as many answers as there are vets when you have questions like this. My personal thing, I like the tinctures. If for those of you who are maybe not familiar with tinctures, how many of you would know about tinctures? Okay, so there's a few that don't. So tinctures are, think of it as botanicals that are put into an alcohol base, and some of the organic compounds get drawn off of the botanicals into this alcohol. And we have a way that we can then use the ingredients from those particular botanicals as medicine. The one that I like, it's a Dr. Paul's product. You know, okay, I'm going to do a pitch here, but it's not just to do a pitch. It's because these are the things that I work with. There's one called CEG, which is cayenne, echinacea, and garlic, and that is one that can be administered. I would always do it in the mouth. It can be put into water, things like that. And if you have an animal that has some mastitis, if you have an animal that has a uterus infection, that would be a good frontline one to do. Just in general, that's a good one to have on hand. I would have that one in a toolbox. And as far as how much to administer, I would do 6 cc's twice a day of that one. Another tincture that I use in those situations, because if you have a mastitis or uterus infection, you probably will have a temperature and they're going to be off feed. Another one I use is called Wiljohn. It's willow bark and St. John's wort. So Wiljohn. And that one, same dosage, twice a day, that helps to bring temperature down, helps to reduce inflammation. Okay. As far as the baby pigs are concerned, when you're working them, baby pigs need iron. So I think the injectable iron is certainly a good way to go with that, to do that early on. Yes. May or may not be adequate.
Okay.
Might be adequate.
Because it was like, sure. They usually throw it off pasture and they need maybe supplements, so they said that's the most natural way for them to get it. So
sure. If you have that situation where they're on pasture most all the time, the gilts or the sows are, I think you might be able to get by with it. You certainly won't have problems with every pig, but if you do end up with some issues, then I would go with the injectable iron. Okay, yes. So the question was, with regards to iron, is it sufficient if the animals just have access to dirt as opposed to an injectable iron dextran?
The dirt would be great for the piglets to eat all the other probiotics and all the other things that are in the dirt, but it most likely would not be enough, especially in the Midwest. Another thing that tincture products and herbal products that work really well, depending on how the uterus is, if she passed her placenta, or if the udder has any swelling, a tincture called Colophyllum. That's a really good tincture in our toolbox for contracting down the uterus. I don't know if it's a cow or a pig. It's a really good, good natural product to use, a tincture-based product. We use it a lot in cows to try to help them pass their placenta or an infected uterus. There's other first step and other tinctures that are really good for that. For the udder itself, if there was any mastitis, the Savvy Udder would be essential oil-based product. Massage onto the udder would be good if there's any mastitis. But the Colophyllum is something that's always in the toolbox along with CEG.
Another product, as they are farrowing, oxytocin is very valuable. That is approved for use, a special use in organics. You can't do it to just get milk let down for the sake of improving production. But as long as you have an open cervix and the pigs are presented that they can come, sometimes on these gilts, if they're going to be tired out or whatever, a little boost of oxytocin is going to help them keep the pigs coming. So that's another one to consider. And iodine for navels, too. My feeling with iodine with navels, the 7% strong tincture of iodine is by far and away the best. I don't know where to find that right now. So options that are out there, there's a 1% tincture that's out there, and there is a 7% that's called triiodine. Triiodine is what they would call a tamed iodine. So you have the advantage of the iodine, but you don't have the advantage of the alcohol, which is in a strong tincture, and that helps to dry those navels out. That helps in terms of preventing navel-type infections. So.
Thank you.
Keep making sure the piglets are dry and warm. Good management that way, plenty of bedding. Yes?
I would also add, I had a gilt that wasn't very receptive to her babies right away, and having a little beer on hand is helpful too. Sincerely.
Yeah.
And it calmed her down a little bit, and she was able to be more receptive to her babies.
Very good point, yes. I don't know if anyone heard that, but I would repeat it. So the suggestion was, especially with guilt, sometimes they will not be calm, they will not be receptive to accepting the piglets, and so beer will help. Unfortunately, Dr. Sarah nor Dr. Paul sells the beer. You'll have to source that somewhere else. There have been situations where I've recommended the beer for the farmer and for the pig.
It worked
really well.
Yeah. While you're waiting.
So, I've been asked if dark beer is better than light beer. It doesn't matter. You know, so whatever the preference is. Thank you for that. Okay. Next question. Anybody else have? Yes.
Back to the dirt idea. Is that beneficial for fat cattle? Because my cattle sure seem to like the dirt.
So the question is dirt beneficial for fat cattle or cattle that are fattening, that they do enjoy the dirt? I will ask as a follow-up question, when you're referring to fat cattle, are these that are on what percent grain? A fair bit of grain, or are they pasture?
Full feed.
They're on full feed, yes. So with regards to the needs for the fat cattle and what dirt could do for them, they are looking for something, in my opinion, that's trying to buffer that rumen. It's either that or they're looking for some trace minerals that they're not able to get with the ration or the mineral that's being fed. So dirt certainly can be okay. I think there's better ways to possibly handle that. My concern is if they eat too much dirt, that sometimes that in of itself can be an issue in terms of how their rumen is working and how their gut is working. So things that I like, I'm not a real big fan of bicarb, because bicarb into an acid type of rumen is going to produce gas, so you end up with more gas. Not a problem if they can belch normally. I like to do things, I particularly like things called humates. So humates would be, think of it as old carbon sources ancient forests that get compressed down. So it is a carbon source. The humates will have what's called humic acid and fulvic acid in it, which are beneficial for exchange of toxins coming in and out of the body, kind of normalizing that gut. So I think it would be beneficial to feed humates. You could mix that right into the feed. I think that might help to reduce their desire to want to chew on things or want to lick on things. Another thing is that very often they, in my opinion, they can be low on calcium or phosphorus, so increasing the amount of mineral in your feed ration. I personally like to have 1% of calcium carbonate in any grain ration that I make for cattle, sheep, or goats. So just the free flow, there's Unical M, it's just a feed grade, limestone feed grade calcium carbonate. And I think you might help yourself a little bit by doing something like that also.
Would you recommend the humates for goats as well?
So the question is, would you recommend humates for goats also? Yes, I do like to have goats or have humates as part of my mineral mix that I would say.
I mean, if they're on full roughage, do you think it's necessary?
I really like humates for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. So even if it's not for the buffering capacity, I'd like to have humates as being fed. And we can go into, you know, some thoughts on that as a part of another question. Sarah, what would you, any thoughts with regards to that?
To the original question, I think it's very important to have, I mean, Dr. Detloff told me you can either pay the veterinarian or you can pay for good nutrition. So having free choice mineral, I think, is always having free choice mineral, maybe kelp and humates. Those would be the three things that I think should be free choice or force fed in any animal on your farm. And it can cover up a lot of deficiencies that there might may or may not have with the feed, depending on the feed test. So whether that be your goats or the your fat cattle, dairy cows,
pigs also.
And if they don't need it, they won't eat it. Especially if it's not mixed in with candy, extra molasses, extra grain.
Where is a good place to find to purchase humates? Is that something you'll find at TSC, Fleet Farm, or is it more specialty? And are we looking at 50-pound bag?
So the question was, where's a good place to purchase humates? Usually not at your farm, at your Fleet Farm, farm stores like that. It's more of organic, biological feed stores, usually 50-pound bags, 40-pound, 50-pound bags. Midwest BioAg, Fertrell, those are ones that I know, but I'm sure a lot of other places do as well.
Yeah, sure. And in terms of cost, with the humates, they're relatively inexpensive. Typically, in our area, it would be $28, $29 for a 50-pound bag. And
very
for
reasonable.
Cattle, if they're eating an ounce mm-hmm. to 2 ounces a day would be about maximum.
It's a nice insurance policy. Yeah. Humates are good. Good for the gut, good for... Yeah. There's once in a while you'll have some mold in the feed. It's just a nice thing to have on.
Okay. And preferred to offer free choice, not mixed in with kelp, salt,
right,
molasses.
Separate, because then, yes.
So they kind of self-medicate.
Right. Okay. On our farm, you'd notice the cow with a sore tummy or the one that would be eating it. I mean, it's good to have it. We would always force feed some in the ration, but having it free choice, the one that has the sore tummy, they're the one that's eating more of it. The one with the cow with the sore foot, they're over eating more mineral or kelp because they need it.
Okay.
Good question.
You said to look out for bicarbs too, like what, like things of them?
So the question is, why would I be concerned about feeding bicarb or using bicarb? I just feel that for the dollars that you spend, mm-hmm. there's different ingredients that are going to do multiple things. Bicarb is simply going to be a buffer. It's simply going to reduce acid.
There's better options,
better
choices.
Yes. Dr. Guy.
In regards to the humate stuff, aren't a lot of them labeled as soil amendments and they're really not labeled as a feed ingredient?
That's
so
true.
Or
charcoal is another, charcoal or charcoal is another. They have to, the labeling is to get around regulations.
Okay. Dr. Guy's comment was that a lot of the humates are not labeled as an animal feed additive. There is one, I believe the one that was originally labeled for animal use was called Reed's Sedge Peat. Reed's Sedge Peat. Talking with Dr. Detloff here just yesterday, he said he thinks that there's getting to be less and less concern about feeding that particular humate. The soil type of humates that are out there can be used for livestock also. Dr. Guy, have you had other companies that you like the humates from or that you had experience
with? Not particularly, but I know there was a place in Indiana where they were mining humates where it was approved for animal feeding.
Okay.
So the label, you know, the organic program doesn't have a problem with feeding humates, but
sure.
the feed control, the AFCO, unless they're specifically listed for that, you're not, you know, legally you're not supposed to feed the animals, but a lot of people do, because like the charcoal is a very popular one.
Sure. Okay. Yep. So
it's not going to harm the animals.
Sure.
Maybe right. We should go way in the back. The lady in the back
yes,
had a
okay.
question.
Certainly.
We have beef cattle, and we have this one cow that has a large hoof wart, and we're not going to get rid of it. We don't know why. Do you have any suggestions on what we could do to help with?
Sure. So the question is, there's a beef cow that has a very large wart-type structure on her hoof. And is what could we do about that? So the question that I would ask is, where is it located? Is it located front foot, back foot? Is it located then at kind of in the front between the claws?
It's located on the back foot at the very top.
Between the claws, okay.
Right on the top.
Sure.
On the top, not in the back.
Okay, yes. So that one, I don't know if I have the right name for it, but I call it a varicose wart. There are different types. There's hairy warts, which some of you might have experienced, which is going to be something that is most typically going to be on the back of the hoof. It's going to be kind of a reddish, very sore, bleeds easily, might have little fimbriae or little things that stick out from it. But if I'm picturing it right in my mind, this is in front and it's just kind of a glob that grows out and it's
how
just
big
a
is
big
it about?
Chunk.
Oh, wow, big.
So, okay. So with those, the only thing that I've been able to do that helps with those is to have them excised, is to get them so that you get that foot up and you're able to cut that out. It's going to be a very bloody type of process. They can grow back. I like to wrap those to make sure that they're wrapped, you know, for blood control, for one thing. The other thing is to try to get rid of the wart that would be there. Doesn't really seem to respond to any type of a traditional wart vaccine like you would have on cattle. I do like to do, again, like an iodine type of thing. But again, without being able to get the triiodine, I don't know if we can get strong enough. Dr. Paul has a foot salve that I've had success with on that one. On the organic side, I like plantain, if you can have plantain powder to do as a poultice on that. So just a glob of plantain powder, moisten it a little bit, and then I will use either gauze or paper towel or whatever works, and then vet wrap to wrap it that way. So.
I've used a lot of essential oils on warts. I've recently, in the last year, been treating a couple horses that have some big warts that I think it's in Kentucky, that keep coming back after they're incised. And I make up a blend of, the main ingredient would be frankincense, and it works really well, and we've controlled, dried them up, they've fallen off, and keep them from growing back. So. Essential oils are really good to prevent. I think it still needs to be incised, but then to keep it from growing back, packing it with some different essential oil blends. Feel free to reach out if after you get it incised or want a blend that you can pack in there. But essential oils have worked really good for removing small tumors and warts.
So this is another one of those things that we can take liberties as veterinarians and say, well, you should try this.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me, I understand what the logistics are sometimes to catch a beef cow.
Especially down at the foot.
Yeah. Next question.
Ringworm in calves that are, I would say, 3 months to 6 months in the wintertime in the barn.
Okay.
How do you handle that?
Okay, the question is, how do you handle ringworm in calves that are in a barn 3 to 6 months of age in the wintertime? So, do you want to start with that one?
Sure.
Or otherwise, I
won't. Yes. Besides having good nutrition, do they have access to mineral and any kelp or mineral? I would make sure that that would be an access to them. But essential oil-based products work really well. So either like the arnica ointment or the D-lysine mange, if they're, you know, I imagine these are calves, they're not wild, they're not right, so you can rub it on. Either the Utter Savvy or the arnica ointment, those both are really good at antifungal, which is what ringworm is. It's a fungus. It's slow to grow under a microscope. It looks like a tree. Slow to grow, slow to die. So getting the, you'll heal it up even faster if you can curly comb a lot of the dead cells. And
once they're outside, you're fine.
Right, exactly. Once they get out to the sun.
It's just the winter.
The long winter months.
Yes. So with ringworm, it's going to stay in the building. So certainly low sunlight, the fact that they're inside, they're exposed to those spores.
Humid,
On one thing that sometimes can help is an injectable vitamin A, D, and E. Vitamin A is going to be kind of a big one with that.
For the skin.
My kind of spiel with regards to vitamins, this is one of my little soapbox things, is that typically when we're feeding a mineral or we're feeding a feed, it can have plenty of vitamin A, D, and E in it. They're cheap ingredients. I believe they're always included the way that they should be. My concern is that if vitamin A, D, and E are in a mineral mix that has a substantial amount of salt, say more than 10% salt, has iron in it, either of those two can denature the vitamins by being in there and being in contact with those. You don't know when those minerals are manufactured. It might have been a month ago, might have been 3 months ago, but I really feel that doing a supplemental A, D, and E at the time of feeding or close to the time of feeding is beneficial. So that way you know that those vitamins are going to be strong. If you look at what happens in pasture animals, they're picking up a really good supply of vitamin A in the pasture. And that's going to last in the liver roughly 6 months. So, you know, this maybe does not apply necessarily to your young animals, but I see this so often. You get to March, you get to April, and you'll get the breaks of the pneumonia. You'll get cows, the worst cow pneumonias are going to be in the spring. And I really think that there's a correlation that way. So a way to get around that is to buy just a vitamin A, D, and E supplement and then to add that in. To what Sarah was saying, as far as if you're providing a kelp, if you're providing humate, something like that, I typically will mix some supplemental vitamin A, D, and E into that mix or just do it as part of a top dress or part of a feeding program. But that can help also. Sure.
And the vitamins are broke down in the feed around this time of the year, too. They're no longer available because they've been stored since the summertime.
Yeah.
Okay. Go back to your humates in the pre-choice programs.
Yes.
Are there other requirements if we don't move it, our feeders from one pasture to the other? Is there other requirements that will come and want to get at that, too?
Okay, so the question is, if I understand it, with humates, if you have them out in a mineral feeder and pasture, and the animals are moved to a different pasture, will there be animals or critters that are going to want to get into the humates and eat them or contaminate them? I've not had any concern with that. That doesn't seem to be something that normal little animals are going to do. I can't comment about deer. To me, it would make sense that deer might, but
that would be my concern.
They probably wouldn't.
Deer can spread certain diseases.
Sure.
Back to
sure. The fact that deer are out in the environment and they have, wild animals have that ability to access anything that they need in the environment to balance their gut, and they're also, they're not domesticated to the point that they don't know what to eat and how to eat. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be a big concern.
Well, in our area, because of the wolf chasing them, they're coming into the more populated areas. So
they are.
Flower gardens, everything else are getting eaten well by deer.
Okay.
they come to where it's safer for them.
Oh, sure, sure. They do, they're more of an issue for you then. Yeah.
I would think that they would be going after the hay or the feed, looking for calories. If they're short amount of time in the farmyard, I would think that's what they're going to be.
I would not be overly concerned. Yeah, I would not be overly concerned. Sure. Okay. Next question.
What's a good organic product for mange and lice in stockhouses?
Okay.
We have an essential oil product called D-Lice and Mange that on contact it will kill lice immediately. The key is what kind of animals you have, beef cows?
Yes.
To get them get close enough to be able to spray them. So yeah, we have a product, Dr. Sarah's Essentials D-Lice and Mange that works well. The, like I said, the lice, if you don't get a good coat on them, the lice are going to, you know, hide under their armpits or go wherever they can get away from the product. But it definitely is a good product to spray and will kill the lice.
What's it called?
D-Lice and Mange.
Can you spell that?
D-E-L-I-C-E and then Mange, M-A-N-G-E. There's a lot of blends of essential oil. I don't have the list right in front of me right now, but there's, yeah, it's big. Yes.
That's
it's the ingredients are on the website, but there's tea tree and there's cinnamon. There's quite a few others as well. And it's mixed with oil and water, so it sprays, but there's some oil in there as well, so it has some it will stay. Every day for up to a week, depending on how bad the lice are. Sometimes you can get them in two or three treatments and then repeat in 3 weeks if the lice are bad. If there's a big, and do you see a lot of licking and a lot of scratching?
Just some hair loss.
Okay.
Organically managing lice is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I use Dr. Sarah's product. Our cattle, our cows are very tame, so we can work with that. But it just seems like that it's not a real easy solution. I would say in the conventional world, it's no different. There's enough resistance built up already to the on the conventional side that I see the same sort of thing. So it's not like it's just the organic world. Things that I think about with that too, and again, it goes back to that overall nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer in having some type of a, what I would call the micro trace minerals. You know, they talk about trace minerals, they talk about zinc, they're talking about copper, selenium, and those. I'm talking about the ones that you need an even smaller quantity. There isn't a lot of really solid research with each of them, but these would be ones that you would source from the ocean, from the sea. If you look at, there's three primary products that I work with. You've probably seen, most be aware of Redmond salt. Redmond salt would be an ocean salt that they mine. There's another one called C90, SEA-90. That is a kind of a fresh or a new ocean salt. What they do is they harvest that from tide pools in Baja area. The 90 is referring to all these micro traces that are out there. And the third one would be kelp. So kelp is growing in the ocean, and seaweed that's growing in the ocean, it's pulling those traces, making it part of a plant. So you know, any of those, any one of those three, I feel are a really good thing to have as your salt source. Or not, you know, with the kelp, obviously it's not the salt source, but to have one of those three as a source so that those animals are getting the traces. The other part with that is FDA has a restriction on the amount of iodine that can be included in feed. Now, higher iodine is beneficial for reducing insect load. Mm-hmm. So in my opinion, animals that have good access to these traces, the higher iodine that is coming from either one of these three sources is going to reduce the load that you have of the lice. Redmond salt and C90 both have products now that have garlic in it. Typically, the garlic is used for fly control in the summertime. It's not going to kill the flies. It'll be a repellent. I think there's a little bit of a benefit of feeding that even in the wintertime because that garlic is not appealing to the lice. So it ends up being a number of different things that a person does in order to make
one
better.
Thing I just want to say with that, just a small story. Our neighbor always, their cattle always had pink eye, always had pink eye. And the cattle would come right up to our cattle and their cattle would be licking each other through the fence, and we never had pink eye. And I really contribute that. I mean, this was 10 years and running. I really contribute that to the good nutrition, the minerals, and the kelp. And my husband would tease he would run out of kelp, and I'd be like, how come we're out of kelp? We're supposed to have kelp for these animals. And he's like, why don't you just put my wallet in the feed mill or in the mineral bin? But the flies they didn't stay between fences. They were the same flies carrying the pink eye bacteria, and I really contribute that to the good nutrition. And if an animal or flies or any bacteria, pest, parasite, they're going to go after the animal that has the poorest immune system.
Very true.
Okay, right. What about DE for external parasites like that?
Okay, so the question is, how about DE, which is diatomaceous earth, for lice control or external parasite control? This will be just it's all opinion, I guess, but this would be my opinion. There can be benefit to it. I have a little bit of a concern with DE just in terms of the application of it. It is a very, very fine dust. It's a silicate, so it's sharp dust. I don't like that to get in lungs. So as an applicator, we can put a mask on so we don't get it in ours. The cattle can't. So I have a little concern with regards to that. This dates back early years in practice. It was my first organic producer. We would do that. We would have these animals and we would cloud them with DE. And it seemed to have worked, but I was concerned about the other parts of it. What has been your experience with using it?
I mean, it seems to work. I've not lost any bit of the parasites, but it's a young herd, and I'm just
sure.
It's an easy choice because it's cheap and it's everywhere. And it's
right.
It works like magic for us.
Did it?
Yeah.
It does. Okay.
All the time. For years and years. And we learned from Bob Johnson.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're referring to the lice?
Yeah.
To the lice.
And
okay.
It just is magical.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. But like you say, get your mask on.
Mm-hmm.
We used to put it on all cows, go out right down the herd. And it's really crazy, but the white ones get it more. It really is true. And we have we have everything, but we have Holstein mostly. And it's just really, if you really spot your cows right away in, beginning of November, kind of.
Sure.
And really start and just spot, spot checking.
Yeah.
You don't have to do the whole herd then anymore.
Okay.
So it's been magical for us.
Okay. So the comment here, just so that it's recorded, had very good luck with using diatomaceous earth and doing it as a spot treatment for the certain animals that need it the most. One thing that you said, which is really important, I think, is you said you start in November.
Yeah.
So by nature early. Of just letting you know what the life cycle is for lice is that summer sun and heat kills lice. So you don't have these issues in your animals over summer. There are lice that migrate down. They come down on the belly. They come in the areas out of the sun. That's where they spend their summer. And then as the conditions and the temperature and the sun strength is going down, they start to migrate up. So by doing this early, doing it in November for the first application is going to be very beneficial because you're knocking those breeding animal or breeding lice down.
Can I expand that question too about DE? It's like, what about
yes.
Like deep litter bedding and internal usage and just kind of generally, like, what are your thoughts?
Okay, so the question is with regards to diatomaceous earth in putting it in deep litter bedding or doing it internally for parasite control. Do you want to start with that one? Or
I think it can be very beneficial. Not only is it be a drying agent, which would be good in a wet environment, but we have customers that use it and like it.
I just, it's like what you were talking about earlier.
Right.
Sure.
And like you said, it's cheap.
Yeah.
I do have producers that are including it at a low inclusion rate in their TMR mixes for cattle. And from the standpoint of being one of many things that can be beneficial for reducing parasite, internal parasite loads, yes, I feel it definitely does help.
Is there any difference if I added to the pig feed just a small amount to their, if we make a mash or start to ferment it, that's not going to affect the how effective it is?
No.
If it's wet, because we're talking such a small micro level that it's sharp at.
Right, right. Okay. I wonder how much of that, how sharp it is after it gets wet. I don't know the answer to that. I would think it wouldn't be as...
Sure. So the question was, it be effective if we're mixing it in for swine and putting it into a mash or into their feed? And yes, I believe that it is still effective. If you look at any time anything would be fed, no matter how you are feeding it, once it's in the gut, it's in a liquid form anyway.
Sure. Right.
It's going to get wet.
Right.
And kind of what ends up happening, the way that it works on internal parasites is they are very thin-walled. They do not have much of a skin, if you will. And so it's just the little slices as that DE goes past them starts to make them leak cytoplasm, leak the stuff from inside the parasites.
So it's and physically...
It's a physical thing, yes. It's a physical thing with that. Yep. So, okay. Yes.
I have a dairy cow question. So I'm not new, but I've had her for about 3 years, and I just got my first milk test done.
Okay.
So I felt like this was my report card for her. And I got my single cell count back on her milk, and I felt like it was a little high. It was 150, and I don't know, is that high? And if it is there anything to do to lower it? And then the second question, just because I got the opportunity, is there anything that you can do to increase she's hard to get bred back. So what things could I do to make her more receptive breeding-wise?
Okay, so the question, two-part question. One is, with a dairy cow with a somatic cell count of 150,000, is that high, is that significant, or is it normal? The second part of the question was... tell me again.
She's hard to get bred.
Hard to get
bred. Okay, sir. The second part of the question was, she is difficult to get bred back. And so what can you do to make it easier for her to get bred back?
150 somatic cell count is not bad. I mean, it could be lower, but it's pretty good. How old is she?
I think she's about 6 or 7.
So she's about 6 or 7 years old. I think that is a pretty decent somatic cell count for that age of a cow.
Yeah.
Do you have any cultures? It'd be different if she, does she have any signs of mastitis, any chunks, any, okay. For that age of cow, I think that's a good somatic cell count.
It varies by age.
Well, just as they get older, their integrity of the teat ends aren't the same as they were when she was the first lactation animal. And when was that test taken?
Like 2 weeks ago.
Sure. And is the weather hot, cold, muddy?
It's very cold. We're in like minus, I'm up north.
Okay.
So, and she's outside.
I think that's a decent somatic cell count. I mean, it always could be lower. 50 would be amazing, but 150 is a good somatic cell count.
So don't worry about it. No.
Right.
A good report card.
That is a good report card. And then for breeding back, how is her body condition?
Amazing. It's like a 3.
That's good.
Like I have her daughter, and her daughter's super easy to get bred back, but she is just really challenging. It's like every other year for her. So.
Does she show you heats and just doesn't settle, or do you not see heats?
She's difficult to see when she's in heat.
Okay.
I was thinking about doing time day high, but we have we do boarded beef cows, so I just throw her out with the beef bulls the last 2 years here. Mm-hmm. But even with the bull, she didn't take this last year.
Okay. Well, a few things that I think about with that. If you're not seeing heats well, or if you're not certain if she's having heats, is it possible that she would have what's called a pyometra? So a pyometra is a condition in the uterus where you would have, think of it like a certain amount, can be a small amount, can be a large amount of pus. This is not the smelly type like you would get after you would have a uterus infection when they're fresh, but that small amount of pus has a negative feedback loop so that they do not come in heat. There's a thing called the corpus luteum, the CL, that holds them not in heat. And that gets correlated in with that pus. So you can go for months and months where they never will show a heat. That could be determined if someone did a rectal exam to see if that's the case. Otherwise, you know, what we're talking about with regards to trace minerals, good nutrition, especially a lot of those, the traces and the vitamins are going to be beneficial for them to show heats a little bit better.
I don't know what a humate is.
Okay, sure.
I know what the kelp is.
Okay,
and she
sure.
does have the minerals, but I don't know what this humate is that y'all are talking about.
All right, so if the yeah. So,
okay.
So yeah, the question is, what is a humate? What is a humate like? So if you picture opening up a 50-pound bag, and it would be very fine granular, and you'd stick your hand in it, and you'd pull your hand out, and your hand would be just black. It's just a fine powder. It's a carbon. Think of it a little bit like what the color of charcoal, like charcoal briquettes, that type of thing, but just ground up real fine. Okay, so getting back to what you can do for that particular cow, if the nutrition and those type of things are good organically, we can. There's a couple of the Dr. Paul products. The one is called the caulophyllum tincture that Dr. Sarah had referenced with the pigs. That is one, if there is some pus in that uterus, it will open the cervix up and it'll get that pus to pass out. Okay, then you break that cycle so then they can come into a heat. If you do that and she shows you a heat, even if there is a white discharge, you're safe to breed. They're going to settle. Most of the time they're going to settle. There's another tincture called Nature's Cycle, which is, and again, I can't tell you the list of ingredients in that particular tincture, but that one is beneficial for instituting the heat cycles. Typically on those, I'm using 6 cc's once a day in a mouth for a week, and you see benefits coming from that.
I will also use an injection of multi-man on some of these animals that won't breed, copper, zinc, and manganese, and research has shown that there's 90% of the manganese in the body is stored in the ovaries, and so in case there is a deficiency, that's a one-time injection that's good to give. You'd have to get it from a veterinarian. But it's a good item to product that I will give to cows that aren't coming into heat.
Yep. So that's it's prescription, but it is organically approved. Mm-hmm. Not a problem for organics. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Yes.
I'm sorry. Earlier when you were talking about higher iodine loads and we're talking about DE for internal parasites, would a higher iodine content in food potentially also preemptively try to reduce internal? Are there other things beyond just DE mixed with food just to be more proactive in reducing
that? Okay, so the question is, are there other things that we could use in food, and is a high iodine level something that is going to be beneficial for reducing internal parasites? Okay. So you want to start with this one, otherwise I'll take off on it.
Go ahead. You can go ahead with that. That's a big question. That's a loaded question. That's okay.
My personal experience is that iodine by itself necessarily would not improve internal parasite reductions, but there are things that can help that can improve that. So when you look at internal parasites, if you just step back and look at that, they're going to be taking in the case of pigs, it can be infective eggs. In the case of ruminants, it can be infective larvae. And those are getting into the gut. They're going through the gut. As they're going through that gut, they need to be able to attach to the lining of the gut for things to happen. So the approach that I take, what I like to do is, what can we do to maximize the ability of that gut not to have that happen? How can we keep it so that they can't get to those sensitive cells in the lining of the gut? A couple things that are natural defense mechanisms for that. One is, there's on the lining of the gut, there's what's called a mucin layer. So think of mucus, thick jello type stuff, and that is going to protect those cells. That's difficult for a larvae to be able to penetrate that. Within that mucin layer, then you have your probiotics, you have your immune cells. So in addition to the physical barrier, you also have an opportunity for the good things in your biome to be able to produce an immunity, an immune reaction, to be able to get rid of the larvae that are coming by. So a product that I really like that seems to work really well, have any of you heard of Pharmatan? Pharmatan is a sweet chestnut tannin. It actually comes from Slovenia. Slovenia is a little country in Europe someplace, and apparently they have tons of these sweet chestnut trees. This is an OMRI-approved product, and there's a number of different compounds in this tannin, and that helps with a couple things. One, it helps to improve that mucin layer. It also helps to tighten the junctions between cells. If you've ever heard of leaky gut syndrome, whatever, it's good for that. And it also has some direct effects on those larvae. So the Pharmatan, like I said, is organically approved, and it is something that can be part of a feeding program. Now with Dr. Paul's, who came up with a product that's called Clean Start Pellet. Clean Start is a product that has the Pharmatan in it, it has essential oils in it, and it has prebiotics in it. One would think that you would have to feed this all the time. The experience that I've had with the Pharmatan, with the Clean Start Pellet, so we've had it out 2.5 years now and have done a lot with sheep and goats with it. It has been fed. We do it for pigs. We do it for cattle. Doing a once-a-month treatment seems to really set that gut up in good shape for doing that. So
that's a good product.
That type of thing would be my approach to it. Sarah, if you have other...
No, that's a great product. Also, this won't apply for the pigs, but for just parasite load in general, overgrazing is a big issue, and whether in sheep and in cattle. So having rotating, and larvae can climb up 3 to 4 inches up the stem of a plant, and then the cows or the sheep or whatever are ingesting those larvae and reproducing, and then just the cycle keeps going, passing. So rotating and not grazing too short, to not have overpopulation on that pasture, is really important for parasite control. It's easier to prevent than to treat, for sure.
Okay. Okay.
Well, it's a little bit on top of that last one. You said that that product is mostly for the tannin content, but are there not, is that that's the case?
There's polyphenols in there. The gallic acid is a big one. The actual tannin itself is a desiccant. Okay. That is part of how it works that way.
Okay.
Okay. Back there, please.
Can you explain why taking a half a cup of dry sugar and a half a cup of Martin's iodized salt will treat pink eye, and take a calf that's been blind in both eyes and after 2 treatments you can see just as good as ever? I've been using that for over 30 years and I've never lost a head of cattle with pink eye where the eye remained blind.
Okay.
I just like an explanation. An old guy told me this a long time ago, and I thought he was crazy. And I thought, where do I got the loop?
Sure.
I did.
So it was a half a cup of Martin's iodized salt, and what was the other
sugar.
Half a cup?
And a half a cup of sugar.
Okay.
And you just take it and then mix it together, put it in your hand, and go up to the blind side. I can treat stock cows in a corral just by walking up to them because they can't see you.
Sure.
And you just take it and pat it in their eye,
mm-hmm.
and you do it once or twice, and they're treated.
Okay. So the question was if we could explain why the remedy of using a half a cup of Morton's iodized salt and a half a cup of sugar mixed together and applied directly to the eye in a pink eye animal, why that would work. I don't have an answer to that one. I'll defer that one to Sarah. I
do not have an answer. Dr. Guy.
Dr. Guy.
So sugar is antibacterial. And the way it works is it draws the water out of the situation. The bacteria need water to grow. Sugar, if it's in solution, it's a fuel for bacteria. So the fact that it's dry is important. The salt, I don't like that going in the eye. Can you imagine how much that burns in the eye of an animal? So I think go with the straight sugar, and I think it'll work just as well. I don't know if you've ever tried just sugar by itself. But that's when people use sugar or people use honey. Honey actually has more biologic, more things in it, but the sugar works by drawing fluid out of the system, and that just kills things because they don't have water. So that sugar, you can use it topically. Honey is a great thing to use topically. But sugar, there was a woman in Wales that we had a meeting like this, and she was talking about a cow that didn't pass her placenta, that didn't clean. And she had a remedy, and what she did is she just got sugar cubes, like you buy a box of sugar cubes for coffee, and she would just push them through the cervix, and just a handful of sugar cubes. And I've told 3 or 4 farmers that remedy, and they've been just really happy with it. So sugar itself is probably doing the work. Salt is an irritant. It must burn like hell, so I would not put that in the eye.
Sure.
So the response, in case the audio didn't pick up, Dr. Guy said the sugar, is it antibacterial, has antibacterial property. That in itself would work without the salt. The salt, it would burn the eye on animal welfare situation. That just would not be a good idea to use. Try just the sugar.
What the iodized salt, is that a colloidal, the iodine in there? How do they get it iodized, I guess? That would, how much potency are you dealing with iodine? What? Maybe that's part of the answer to that question.
Sure. So it would not be a colloidal, so the question was, with the iodized salt, is the iodine in a colloidal form, and would that be contributing to the benefit to the eye? So I, as best I know, that would not be in a colloidal form. It would be a sodium iodide, I would guess, would be the ingredient that they would use for an iodine source in the iodized salt. Could the iodine be helping? Yes, certainly the iodine could be helping.
I tried regular salt and it didn't work.
Okay.
In Europe.
Sure.
And so then I went back to, and then all of a sudden I downed on the, I took the salt out of a bag in the machine shed.
Mm-hmm.
So I went the next year and got iodized Morton salt, and it's been working ever since.
Sure.
No problem.
Yeah.
My farrier makes the sugar dine. She calls it, and it's sugar and iodine, and she uses it as a poultice. So she calls it sugar dine, and she has it in like just a Tupperware container and mixes the two and uses it as a poultice for like hooves and stuff. So it sounds like the same concept, but not just on hooves, not eyes.
So the comment on that was that there's a farrier that uses sugar and iodine to use as a poultice when they're working with feet. So I do sugar dining, call it. I do really believe in that power of the sugar and the power of the honey. Dr. Guy pointed that out, that there's so many ingredients, antifungal, they're antibacterial and antiviral properties in honey, an excellent product. I'm old school, I still infuse uteruses that are bad, that you, a post-fresh cow, sheep or goat, really smelly uteruses, I do like to infuse. My infusion recipe is I will use aloe vera juice and water, half and half. I will add honey to it. And then there is an Impro product, which is from Waukon, Iowa. This would be bioactive peptides coming from whey, and there's one called Uterine Care, and I use a half a bottle of that for a cow. That.
And you'll.
Then I would infuse that into a uterus. So in a cow, I would be using it with a pipette, like a 20-inch pipette, trying to, as clean as you can, pass that through the cervix and into the uterus. And put that fluid in every couple of days is what I do.
If the cervix is still open, fairly big, I like to use a calf esophageal feeder. You got that nice soft end on the end of the esophageal feeder. It's easier to infuse and less trauma with a pipette.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. All right. Now to you.
So the question was, for somebody who's just has land and will be getting animals, what would be a good veterinary kit to have? What products would be good to have? What kind of animals do you think you'll start with? Not sure yet?
Not sure. I'm still in research and exploration. But.
So very basic, definitely starting with good nutrition, getting good, stored feed, and very important, depending, if you're around here, what state are you in? Okay, so you don't have as cold a weather as we have, so that's a benefit. You get to have your animals out in pasture a lot. Just good nutrition, like good mineral, kelp, the humates, those are just the basics. Having either Dr. Tom or I, any of the products on our website, we have different lists that we have, but just for starters, but having aloe pellets, having aloe, some of the basic tinctures, CEG would be the first natural antibiotic, some of the essential oil salves for the injuries, wounds. It depends what kind of animals you're going to have. Some parasites, anti-parasites, the calves, the clean start. Calf Start is a good product that is a liquid humate with tinctures. That's the first product that I would always have, whether I'd use it for calves, use it for sheep, goats. It's a nice preventative for sick babies. What do you think? What did I miss? That's a good starter.
I'm a big believer in probiotics.
Yes,
for
probiotics.
Animals that are having issues. Number of different sources for that. There's some that are organically accepted. I don't, I'm relisting, I guess I'm not real familiar with that part of it on some of the paste or the tubes that are out there, but that's a good one. I really like the combination in off-feed animals of molasses and probiotics. So I'm on a molasses kick, really. Like that. B-complex, if you are to have sheep or if you're to have goats, definitely have B-complex available. There's so many things when they go off feed that really helps to get them back on track. And I can say in case you get a llama, B-complex is good too. So those would kind of be the basic ones. A really big part of it, I think, is just to develop a network of people that you can call. Dr. Sarah does consultation, I do consultation, take our cards, and we can help you through those type of things. There's a lot of things that you can do with animals, but it's so situational.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about that. Like, what could I do at home on my own versus
yes.
What would require
sure.
A call to a vet? In
right.
Planning on what type of animals I want to think about their welfare and
right.
Costs.
Sure. Yep, so the comment was to not forget about apple cider vinegar for a number of different purposes. If you're getting apple cider vinegar, make sure you get the one that says with mother. This was a learning curve for me years ago. It's like, mother? What? But the mother is the part that's the good stuff that's in the apple cider vinegar. That has a lot of those things that are going to be prebiotic and are going to be beneficial to the microbiome. So that works with that.
Would you use that on a per need basis, or would you just kind of mix it with the water to free dose?
Okay, the question is, do we recommend using apple cider vinegar on a continuous basis, or is it something that you use in certain situations? And the answer is yes. There are cases where I have people on apple cider vinegar all the time, specifically whitetail deer. I've got a couple deer farms that they keep it going all the time, seems to really help things. Some situations with poultry, backyard poultry, I have on apple cider vinegar all the time. But most of the time, you can do it kind of as situational, when they need it, how they need it. You can do it for a period of 5 days, something in that order.
It's good. It's a good prevention. I take it myself. I think it's good for humans. I think it's good for animals. But the key is not to take too much. I mean, it is an acid, so more is not better.
Yes.
I've worked with Dr. Will Winder on that. We've been putting 40 pounds with the mother in it of organic vinegars per ton of poultry feed, broilers specifically.
Okay.
Stream really helps with the leg issues there. The cones will be a lot redder in the 9 weeks when we grow these broilers.
Okay.
And we picked up a good half pound of feed again, and we actually reduced the amount of feed going in to those animals.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So
it really works. The birds are just so much healthier.
Sure.
It's because the vinegar helps them get more of the carbohydrates out of your grains for more energy.
Okay. And you said 40 pounds, so that's using 40 pounds of
about
a powder?
Gallon bucket.
So of the liquid,
I just dump it in towards the end there and blend it in. Yeah.
Per ton, okay. So the comment was in poultry to use 40 pounds of apple cider vinegar per ton of feed, and that is increasing our feed efficiency. It's increasing the redness of the comb, helping with the legs, which is a big issue.
I do the pigs too, but I don't see the big difference that we do with the poultry.
Okay. All right. Thank you for sharing that. Yes, back there.
I just wanted to add or ask about what the person who was talking about prevention and what your thoughts are on stress and low stress handling and reducing stress in livestock as a way to prevent.
Sure. So the question is, what are our thoughts about the role that stress plays in health? So if we're doing low stress handling, if we're keeping those animals from being in stressful situations, how that affects health. There's a huge, huge effect of stress on animals with regards to health. If you look at, this is another tangent here, but it'll make sense. If you look at the microbiome, which is the accumulation of all the little bugs that are on your skin, in your gut, on your respiratory tract, whatever. If we focus on the gut, then the microbiome is essential for normal function of immunity in the body. 70% of the immune system comes from the gut. There is a thing that's called the gut-brain axis. Kind of goes through the vagus nerve or can go through the bloodstream. And what that does is think about the immune cells and the probiotics in your gut talking to the brain. So it goes both ways, okay? So if the gut is saying something, the brain will, through its hormonal system, through the endocrine system, produce what needs to be done. Vice versa, if the brain is saying something, it'll affect what's going on in the gut. There was a research paper that I read that said stress will reduce the amount of the lactobacillus bacteria in the gut. Lactobacillus is one of the really essential probiotics in the gut, a very vital part of our microbiome, or animals' microbiome. So that is just kind of one place with regards to how stress is going to affect the immune system in an animal's health. The other thing, if you look at stress is going to cause the production of cortisol or corticosteroids from our adrenal glands. And that, as that's circulating through our body, is preparing the body for what they call fight or flight. And cortisol says, okay, there's a danger, there's something we're concerned about here, and so energy gets diverted away from the immune system and more into what happens when you're stressed out. But, you know, you're not thinking creatively, your normal patterns might get changed or whatever. And cortisol also just directly suppresses the immune system. So yes, stress is huge. Stress is huge with regards to that. The other ones that I would throw out, if you just really think about the basics, water, hydration is so important. That's important for this mucin layer. It's important for normal function. It's important for digestion. It's important for respiratory health because you keep the mucus in the respiratory tract to get invaders out. That's something that we don't often think of as being that important. A big part with that, think about if you have animals that are drinking from a waterer, say there's a little bit of stray voltage. So if you have these animals go to a waterer, they should go in, they should stick their head in there, and they should slurp. But very often what you'll see is they'll walk up to a waterer, and they might stand there, then they'll flick it with their tongue, or when they go to drink, they'll put their head in and drink real quickly and pull their head out. So if you're looking at hydration, you want them to be really, really comfortable where they're getting their water from. The second one is air. You know, our beef cows stay outside all the time. They're not inside. They have that good, clean air. Some people would say, okay, well, it's stressful for them to be outside versus inside. But air quality is so important. And if they're outside, they are in fresh air. I can give them bedding. I can make a mound for them. I can keep them happy, fed, comfortable outside. I can't do that inside. So, you know, stress, water, air, basic type of things.
Well, and you see this with calves, too. A customer will call with a pneumonia outbreak, and I'll go to the farm, and, you know, the doors are shut. The ventilation isn't the best, and I say, let's do the knee test where you get, you know, the air up here might be okay at best, but then you get down on your knee where the calf's nose is, that's where they're breathing in all the air, and you can hardly breathe. You know, my lungs are hurting, their lungs are going to be hurting too. They're going to be more susceptible to pneumonia. So good bedding, plenty of bedding, good management, not having overcrowding, and get yourself down to the level to where the animal is and breathe for a half hour and even 10 minutes and see. Air is a big deal.
So one little story that I got to throw in here too. So I, 40 years I've been doing this, so in early part of practice, there were a lot of barns, dairy barns that I would go into. And when we talk about ventilation, air is going to take the paths of least resistance. So often I'd go into a barn and the fan is running here and there's a window open here and the rest of the barn is not getting ventilated. The other thing is, I think some people took pride into how thick can the dust get accumulated on the little louvers on the fan. So the fan is running and these louvers are just trying to open up a little bit. And the best situations were ones where there was such a vacuum in the barn that when you opened the barn door to go in, if they had enough fans running, the barn door would practically hit you in the backside because there was just a vacuum in there. Again, fans that are not doing what they need to do. So just really simple things, if you do have animals inside, is to watch those. Question?
I have a question back to the apple cider vinegar for poultry.
Yes.
What is the most cost-efficient, I didn't know there was dry stuff, but
it's liquid.
But if a guy just day-to-day putting out feed for like 150 chickens or whatever, mm-hmm. How much are they supposed to kind of get
today? Okay, so the question is, with apple cider vinegar for chickens, how much should they get? So I like to medicate through water, or medicate's not the word,
okay,
but
so you should pour it in the water. That was another
yes.
Question.
So I will
feed, pour it in the water.
Yeah, so I will ask you, what is your water system? Is it, what type of water, how do your chickens get water? Let's just say it that way.
I just dump water into a plastic dish like this.
Sure,
you know?
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah, so if they're hand-watered, where they're going into a bowl or a dish or something on that order, for myself, I typically will be looking at 1/2 to 1 ounce of apple cider vinegar per gallon. There's 128 ounces in a gallon. For maintenance, I do 1/2 ounce. If I have flocks that I'm trying to do something specific with, if there's a disease going on that I'm concerned about, then I will go to 1 to even 2 ounces for period
okay,
of time.
But about at least 1 ounce.
At least 1/2 ounce. At least
day.
1/2 ounce.
A
yeah.
Half ounce.
Half at least 1/2 ounce per gallon.
Yeah.
Per day.
I was told that that's supposed to help chickens maybe kick them in for lay, get them to lay sooner.
I have used it in situations where we have drops in egg production, or if we have pullets coming on that aren't coming on uniformly.
Yeah.
And we've had benefits from that. I've had good feedback with regards to that.
Okay, the apple cider vinegar, is there a specific kind the guy should use?
As long as, I prefer organic, and like you said, as long as it says with mother. If you're dealing with chickens, they don't taste it, so it isn't as much of an issue. If you're dealing with some other animals, not to pick on any brands or whatever, but my personal taste, if you get the Bragg's type, if you're doing it in a small amount, a small quantity, Bragg's is pretty bitter, pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
If you get the Dr. Paul's one, they're getting it from an organic orchard that is using all the apples to make their vinegar, not just the ones that are windfalls or whatever. That's a much sweeter one. So, but for chickens, doesn't matter, in my opinion.
And would there be any difference organic conventional apple cider vinegar, would that affect the chickens if, let's say, you can only find regular apple mm-hmm. cider vinegar? I mean, if you give them the same amount, is there anything?
Okay. My feeling with regards to the apple cider vinegar, organic versus not organic, that's the question. I like the idea of it being organic mm-hmm. from the standpoint of apples are, conventional apples are so heavily treated. And if one is looking at just the sum total of the negatives that are going into us or into an animal, the fact that it's organic would be certainly an advantage. If you can't, then you would go the conventional route. Sarah, do you have any?
I agree. It's one of the apples are one of the on the dirty dozen, right? They get sprayed with a lot of pesticides. Conventional would be better than nothing, but organic would be the best. And there's great sources of organic apple cider vinegar with the mother.
Question.
Yes.
Last year we experienced big way too heavy at birth weights,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them. And the only thing I was reading, they did some things with, because our winter was so brutal last year, they said the circulation pattern of the body moves inwards and then the calves get bigger. Have you ever had that in your practice, to come across a year where all of a sudden, you know, 120, 130 pound calf, you know, an old duffer's got a lot to do to try to pull that calf?
Sure. So the question is there something to the fact that, like last winter, where the winter was very extreme, that the calf size on beef herd got excessive? So when normally with Red Angus cows are having normal birth weights, getting up into that 110, 120 pound calves, and is there anything related to the weather, temperatures, and that? I've not run across that, and I don't have a way that I would be able to explain why that would happen. The key ones with regards to birth weight that I look at would be the available energy late into gestation. Every day closer to calving is going to be a faster growth rate on that calf. So if, and I don't know if you had done anything with regards to more silage or higher quality feed.
We just basically feed forage. Just don't do any grain or anything.
No grain or anything like that. So that would shoot that. Genetics is another one, of course, would not be your situation either. Could it have something to do with the metabolism that the blood is kind of more internal or whatever?
Did you use any, was the feed any different this year than last year? Did you feed more of it, higher protein?
It's hard to know when you've got a pile of bales out there and you're hauling and you've got a large number of animals to really watch it. But sure. The only question would be, is way more red clover 1 year than alfalfa and things in the ration, because there's hormonal things that come with red clover.
Yes.
Tracked anything like that too, because it's really hard to lose calves that way, because
yeah.
Herd causes the same process.
Sure.
Dr. Megan in the back, she might have some input.
I was just going to ask whether those are AI or bull breeding, just whether you knew whether the gestation lights could occur.
They're all bull breeding.
Because that can absolutely play a part. I've seen all sorts of things with clovers and sort of estrogenic compounds, to the thing where it would change either getting bred or getting, you know, holding on longer. So if you're having like long gestation life that was resulting in the calves, that certainly can contribute.
The very first one was almost what we would assume would have been 2 weeks ahead. And we were having a lot of delayed calving on it. So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry, I can't give you a better answer on that one. Yes.
We had calves that were almost 2 months in the calf hutches, individualized, and they've been doing excellent, all the way excellent. Okay, all they're getting is they're getting hay, and they're getting the big bottles of milk twice a day. Okay, and then it's never happened any other year. This is the only year that it's happened. Is the calf will get bloody scours and then it'll die. And it was just like you had about a day's time. Okay. I know he took some of that to the vet, but I don't think he ever got an answer. And in fact, I know he never got an answer from him. So that we kind of decided that maybe the only possible change that it could have been was there might have been mold in that hay. Does that make sense that we figured that one out, or does it not make sense that we figured that one out?
Okay, tell me again the time.
Great. They're almost ready to, you know, put in the barn. They're being fed two really big bottles of milk.
Sure.
Every day, and they're almost. Well, I would say they're almost 2 months old already. They're a month and a half to 2 months old.
Okay.
They were the big calves that were ready to go into the barn, the transition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they got bloody scours and died.
Still on milk, though.
Still on milk.
No changes.
And they're only getting hay and they're getting milk.
Sure.
And that was the only thing, and like three of them died.
Did you happen to take their temperature at all?
Pardon me?
Did you happen to take their temperatures to see if any of them had fevers?
I don't think he ever did.
Okay. All right, so the question was, these are calves that are 2 months old, getting two bottles of milk a day, well-nourished, well-doing calves.
Perfect in time, then.
And they also would get hay, and then sudden deaths on some of these. And part of the question is, can moldy hay do that? So the first thing that I would say is I don't believe moldy hay could kill them.
that fast.
Okay. I would, if you have moldy hay, I could see where you could have a diarrhea, where they could lose thrift, hair coat stands up, and that type of thing. But they would not die that quickly from that. The rule outs that I would have with that one would be certainly coccidiosis. Coccidiosis is going to be something that is going to occur at the earliest at 16 days of age. It says that long of a period of time. I'm going to rule that one out. If you see bloody scours at that age, you think about it. But the fact that they're still on milk, I rule it out because it seems like milk will suppress coccidiosis until they get weaned. So often in organic calves where they're getting the whole milk and they're getting it for 2 or 3 months, they're in really good condition. The day they come off of the milk, that suppression is gone, and within a week, you can't believe how bad those calves can look. Mm-hmm. So I mention it because it's important, but it's not what you've got going there. BVD is not going to be a real big issue either. BVD is bovine virus diarrhea. The passive protection from the mother, if you do have it in your herd, is going to last at least 5 or 6 months. I'm going to throw that one out. The one I'm going to say is salmonella, a salmonella infection. There are many different types of salmonella. Some can give you a fever, they're not feeling well, a diarrhea. Some can give you sudden deaths. And as far as which species is which, Dublin is a really bad one. I'm blanking on
Newport.
On one of the other
it's
ones.
Newport.
Newport. So you might have been able to tell something from a test if they would have typed what or grown it on culture and then typed which one it is. But that's not a surprise.
Yeah. Right.
There's salmonella birds that they don't find salmonella when they test it. So what you could do with that or how you could manage it or prevent it in the future, again, I'm a big fan of probiotics. I really like that gut health. That would be something that I would look at if it develops as a pattern. Salmonella I rarely see before 2 to 3 weeks unless it's brought in cattle. So if there's something that you could mix in, I do have ideas if you want to talk to me afterwards.
Okay.
So.
Thank you. And then that was it. We never had trouble again with anybody else. It was like 3 calves in a row.
And that was it, yeah.
Then we were done with it.
The birds brought it in, the rats brought it in, and the herd got accustomed to it, and it's gone.
I'll talk to you. Thank you.
Okay. So we are, we're out of time. I have time. Sarah has time. If we need to vacate the room, we certainly can. If people want to stay and ask questions for a little longer, I'm okay with it.